Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tis the season for fundraising, political fundraising, that is, and the advent of social media has changed the landscape for that in recent years. But the very same strategies, or mostly the same strategies, have been adopted for other types of fundraising, for business startups, and also for charity. Joining us today to talk about the possibilities for charity is Dave Boyce. He's CEO of Fundly. Dave founded three startups back in 1999 and 2000, the third of which he sold to Oracle in 2005. His most recent venture is Fundly, touted as the largest online social fundraising platform in the United States. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi, thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Megan and Adam Bessler, parents of a toddler battling leukemia and the beneficiaries of an ongoing fundraising campaign to help them manage the medical bills associated with their child's treatments. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also Megan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Dave Boyce, I read that you were motivated to get involved with Fundly because of your six kids and also those fundraiser obligations.
Well, that was one of the motivations. I do have six children. And you know, just realized, you know, through either, whether it's scouts or school fundraisers, walkathons, you know, booster club sports, that the kind of door-to-door envelope spreadsheet list backpack rodeo is just not very easy. It just, you know, we're in 2012, at the time 2009, nobody writes checks anymore. We use, you know, we pay online or we pay with credit cards, yet all of these activities, we're still using all of the old methods. And then I looked at political fundraising, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, and even fundraising for other causes, all of the walks and runs that people do for causes, and then the advent of social media, and just realized, wow, there's got to be an easier way to raise money for causes that we care about.
And that's what Fundly does.
That's what we do. We couldn't find an easier way, so we decided to go out and build one. You can start a campaign in 5 minutes, upload some content just like you would onto one of your social network profiles, connect it to your social network profiles, and then post to your social profiles, email out, and be collecting money within 5 minutes.
My guest is Dave Boyce. He's CEO of Fundly. It is a social fundraising tool. If you have a question or comment for Dave, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I read that some $230 million has been raised by groups and individuals using Fundly. Who tends to use it the most at this point? What kinds of groups?
Yeah, we are really gratified by that number. I think we must have struck a nerve. People really need the solution. It didn't exist, and we built it. We've seen, in terms of sheer quantity of people, it's the smaller organizations and people like Meg and Adam who have a cause that they want to raise money for and really, you know, don't have a budget to go spend $10,000 to build a custom website or to kind of set up a custom merchant account and try to kind of integrate in all the tools you would need. But it ranges all the way up to Habitat for Humanity uses Fundly for all of their volunteers who go on build trips. And Teach for America uses Fundly for all of their volunteers who are teaching, you know, out in the inner city or rural schools and are helping raise money for the work they're doing on the ground. So that number is probably mostly attributed to the large causes, to be honest, because of their scale.
Right.
But in terms of sheer numbers of campaigns, most of them are on the smaller end. It's kind of the 90-10 rule.
Now, Fundly is still a business, right?
Fundly is a business,
and so it generates revenue for you from advertisements and that sort of thing?
Well, we don't do any advertising.
Okay.
We take between 3.5% and 4.9% of every transaction. So there's no money to get started, no commitment whatsoever. Out of that 3.5% to 4.9%, we have to pay Visa and MasterCard. So we end up with a a small fraction of even that.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that we've taken venture investment money. We can spend that to build the platform, and if and when we get to a scale, then we'll be able to return a profit. Right now, we're in the building phase and benefiting everyone who's able to use it for no upfront financial commitment.
So Megan and Adam Bessler, Jameson, by the way, is responding well to the treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Good
yes.
news, right?
Yeah.
I read that on Fundly.
Yeah.
Okay. But two more are scheduled. So far, they've raised about $11,000 for your, for your medical expenses. When was the fund set up for you via Fundly? How did that work, Adam?
When he was first diagnosed at the beginning of February, our friends were as devastated as we were, and they really wanted to do something to help. And so my friends Jack and Sierra had decided they were going to start a fundraiser, and they asked us if that would be okay. We told them that was fine, and so Jack went to Fundly, and he started the fundraising website the night he was diagnosed. And we honestly, didn't expect a lot to happen with a traditional fundraiser, and we were just completely overwhelmed. Within hours, it had exceeded the amount that we personally thought it would raise in weeks. And over the next week or two, it reached that amount of $11,000 you're talking about.
Dave Boyce, is that a typical story?
Well, when people are lucky enough, like Meg and Adam, to have good friends, which I presume is the case, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Meg earlier, though, and asked, do you know everyone on the, who's donated? And she's, and this is what's really gratifying. She
mm-hmm.
said, no. I know some of them, but a lot of them are friends of friends or people, colleagues or friends of colleagues from past work. And that is pretty typical. It's, the more compelling the situation and the more kind of networked in the cause or the individual is already, the easier it is to tap those, that extended circle of support when we need it. And it's really, really gratifying to watch that.
So, Megan, how do you get the money? How does that work?
It's actually pretty easy. You just get on, you put in some basic information, and the money is sent directly to your checking account. It's just there. We're actually using most of it for living expenses right now, not medical expenses. Want to be really clear about that. What that allows us to do is to be in the hospital with
right.
Jameson every day. And that's huge when you have a toddler who's battling something so difficult.
How long is he supposed to be in the hospital?
Projected to be about 6 months. So he spent his first month and a half starting last February. We just came back in, and then treatment will hopefully be done by summer, midsummer, late summer.
Is it typical for people to set up accounts for friends and family like that, Dave Boyce?
Yeah, we've seen it's not a use case, honestly, that that we anticipated when we set it up.
Hmm.
We were thinking more about PTAs and booster clubs for, high school football teams and, faith-based organizations and then the larger charities, like you mentioned. Turns out that we just didn't see this use case, and it's happening a lot for health-related or kind of personal tragedy-related. Our neighbor's house burned down. They lost everything. Help them, get themselves back on their feet type thing.
Does it matter? I mean, is there a minimum or anything like that associated with this, a minimum donation?
There is there's a minimum donation right now of $10, and that's it. Everything else is there's no minimum amount that you have to raise. There's no
right.
Like I said, there's no financial commitment up front, so it's really, and there's no per transaction fee, which a lot of services have. It's literally just, set up and raise the money.
I mean, if I'm going to donate $10, that's all I donate is $10. I don't have to spend another $2 to do it, is what you mean
right.
by that per transaction
fee? That happens sometimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That happens sometimes, and the other thing that happens on the back end that's not visible to the donor is sometimes, because of the way Visa and MasterCard are set up, it'll be call it 3% plus 75 cents per transaction, or 3% plus a dollar per transaction. That gets netted out before the funds get remitted. And none of that here. It's just a straight-up fee, really easy to understand, kind of no small print.
How do Megan and Adam, how did people get the word out? Was it just your friends who sent it out to friends and they sent it out to friends, that kind of thing? Have you sent it out?
We put it on Jameson's Facebook, I think, one time. We're fortunate. I actually work at a local preschool, Jane's Montessori Academy, and they were huge. They passed it out. My mother-in-law works at Plain Township Fire in New Albany. And it just, through Facebook mostly, email, it went out like wildfire. I think Adam said it was within a week we had hit the $10,000 goal, and we just couldn't. We didn't want to raise it because we were so proud of everybody and so thankful. It happened so quickly.
Now it's slowed down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now.
Yeah, it has slowed down a lot the last few weeks, but that's fine. It slowed down after we hit our goal, and which is very understandable that once you hit that goal, the mm-hmm. amount of funds would begin to slow down. But we're just so overwhelmed and so thankful, and that's exactly what we expect. We don't need anything else. We're not asking our friends for anything more. Just wanting to get a chance to say thank you.
There's another element to it, Dave Boyce, that I don't know if that's the case with, you know, if it's the Hockey Booster Club kind of a thing, but you can actually send notes from Fundly, from the Fundly page for Jameson to them in the hospital.
There's two-way communication right on the site. So people can make comments on the Fundly site, which, by the way, get cross-posted to Facebook if the person making the comment is logged into Facebook and mm-hmm. wants to cross-post. So now I'm making comments on the site, which are visible by Megan and Adam as well as by any of the other supporters, and becomes part of the reason it goes, you know, like wildfire, like Adam was saying, is to become visible to other people on Facebook as well if I choose to cross-post them. And then the other really nice thing about this platform is that I appreciate as a donor. And often I'll give money to a cause that I care about, and that'll be the last I hear from that cause until next year when they're doing another fund drive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not, it's like, okay, I did this because I wanted to feel part of something bigger than me. So maybe some information about what you're doing with the money or what, you know, are we winning? talking to Megan about Jameson, when she got the diagnosis he brought up, zero cancer cells in the first of these three tests.
Right.
I mean, I'm almost tearing up on the phone, and I'm thinking, and we talk about, well, you know, what you could do is you could go right back to the platform and send a message out to all of your supporters and let them know the good news. I bet they would love to hear it. And
they've done that.
I'm not sure, Megan, if that's what you ended up doing, yeah.
mm-hmm.
They have. That's how I knew.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So, well, Dave Boyce, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, yeah.
It's Dave Boyce, he's CEO of Fundly. Also, Megan and Adam Bessler, parents of Jameson Bessler. He's a toddler. He's battling leukemia. He'll be in the hospital for about 5-6 more months. Good luck with that, and thanks for joining us today to tell us about your experience.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to talk about Google privacy. Do you want it? How can you get it? Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Last month, Rob Gifford of The Economist described something really interesting about Chinese politics.
It all looks rather smooth on the surface, but it's seething underneath.
I'm Neil Conan. After dramatic events at the Communist Party Congress, Rob Gifford returns. Plus, actor Wendell Pierce on his venture into the grocery business. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Mostly sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 82. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60 degrees. More sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 83.
Support for 89.7 comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
In January, when Google announced its new privacy policy, Rachel Whetstone, Google's senior vice president for public policy, told NPR that it's all good.
There's lots of different ways, magical little ways, that we can use information to improve your services, whether it's, you know, better spelling corrections, whether it's enabling you to, you know, add things from your Gmail to your calendar, whatever it might be. It's all really about you, and it's about your information.
But since the announcement, plenty of people have warned of dire consequences from the new policy. Joining us now to talk about the new Google privacy policy and alternative search engines is Steve Fox. Steve is the editorial director and vice president of PCWorld.com and PC World Magazine. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Good to be here, Ann.
You know, that phrase, magical little ways, caught my ears. We already know that Google is collecting data on us every time we use the search engine. How does the new privacy policy change anything?
Well, the main thing about the privacy policy that they instituted relatively recently, actually March 1st, mm-hmm. is that it rolls all of these Google services that currently exist and rolls them into one big bundle so that information on one service can be seen by another, and it's all shared. I mean, there is actually something good about this in that in the past, if you wanted to figure out what Google knew about you or what their policies were, you would need to go to every possible service and read the EULA, that's the End User License Agreement, mm-hmm. Which, let's face it, no one does, mm-hmm. And try to glean from that what their policies were. Now there's one consistent policy across all the services, and to be honest, it's not really all that restrictive. It's not a terrible policy compared to what a lot of people do. I think the problem here is Google has so many services that we all use, or many of us use every day, from, you know, obviously the search engine, or you might be using apps, or, you know, maybe your Android phone. It's all part of Google. So it starts to feel like they're a little like Big Brother. They have all of these services, they find out all this information about you, and there's ways that you could imagine they could put this information together and maybe know more about you than you would like. It's a real, becomes an invasion of privacy when that happens.
Right, and yet that's how Google makes its money, is by collecting data.
Yes, I mean, it is. I mean, when you are using a Google service, you'll often notice if you are, you know, opted in to some of their personalization things, that you'll see ads that seem to make sense based upon what you're searching for, or, you know, who you are. I mean, just think about all the kind of information they could get just from something as simple as, you know, you doing searches every day, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they might have location. They might know, you know, where you are. They might know, you know, so aside from location, they might know the sites. Well, they would know the sites you visit. They would certainly know the ads you click because they're being served through through Google itself. So, you know, they would know that. They know the time of day. I mean, you could go on, and you start to imagine all of this information in one place. This idea of having all of this data put together, there's a lot that can be learned. And, you know, the reality is many of us are willing to give up a good deal of privacy in order to get the kind of convenience that Google and others might be able to offer. You know, this is why on our phones we certainly are very happy in many cases to disclose our location, because, you know, we want to find out where the nearest Starbucks is, or, you know, whatever it is that mm-hmm. you might want for directions and maps. And a lot of us use Google Maps. Obviously, location becomes an important thing. We have cookies, which are, you know, little bits of code that are in your browser, and that information, when you come back to a page, it knows you, it recognizes you, and the page will behave in a way that you expect. That's kind of a good thing. It's convenience. The problem gets to be where you start to have all of your eggs in one basket, and you start thinking, you know, maybe Google might know too much about me.
I went to google.com/ads/preferences. to see what they had on me. And it said that they didn't have anything to show me because I had disabled the cookies.
Right, right.
I don't know when I did that, but I imagine it's something someone told me to do on Facebook if I wanted to.
Yeah, one of the things that you can do right at the beginning is you can try to figure out what Google has on you. There's a page called Google Takeout.
Okay.
And if you go to that page, I believe it's, I think it's google.com/takeout. It has nothing to do with, you know, Chinese food. It's
unfortunately,
just,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you could find something on it, right?
Right.
After all, Google would tell you that, right?
Yeah, they would.
Yeah. So, you know, if you were then logged in to your account, your Google account, and you're on Takeout, you can click on the various services, and you can find out what each service has on you. And then you can go a little bit farther. There's another page. There's a group called the Data Liberation Front. which is, it's a great name, right?
Yeah.
And that's dataliberation.org. And it's actually part of Google, but it's independent in this way. And that's a good place to go to figure out how you can actually remove some of the data if that's what you want to do. So the Data Liberation Front is a good place to start there.
But if everybody did that, then Google wouldn't have the data that they need to generate revenue for their...
Right, but,
for their...
but and let's face it, everybody's not going to do that. For instance,
right.
I haven't done it. And why? Because I'm aware of all this stuff, but I have decided to give up some of my privacy in exchange for the kind of convenience and the services that can provide. I also, you know, there's some cookies that I certainly allow, again, for that convenience. One of the things that you could do is you could imagine spreading out some of your usage maybe to other services that are not Google. You know, that's certainly a possibility. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying that the other places you're going to go are necessarily going to be all that, you know, wonderful or caring about your data. There may still be some issues there, but they wouldn't have all of this information to aggregate. So that's another thing to think about is, you know, possibly some alternatives if that makes you more comfortable.
I read that Google claims that its privacy policy now explains, for the vast majority of their services, what data they're collecting and how they may use it. Do we know what the minority of services that they're not talking about? Is there data that they're collecting that they don't show us if we ask to see it?
You know, I'm not sure about this. I mean, I do know that they have very publicly stated that they do not sell your data, and they seem to really take that pretty seriously. They don't share it with other parties. So whatever that data is, they're primarily using it themselves. Then again, you know, once Google owns the entire universe, just using it among themselves may count as sharing with anyone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is, of course, another situation that if the government were to request things, and there have been certainly legal questions arising out of this, the government might request some information about your Google Mail account, and they had an actual, you know, had something legally binding, they would certainly release that. But I'm really not sure about information that they're not telling you they have. I think, you know, as it is, there is so much information that they have right now that they do talk about, and that should be enough to certainly, you know, scare some people, and not just the so-called, you know, tin hat crowd. it's legitimate that they know a tremendous amount about you.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Steve Fox. He's editorial director and vice president of PC World. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about the new privacy policies put forth that started on March 1st with Google. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page where you can see a bunch of ads that Google has. I don't know what they're doing there. Or you can go to Twitter and tweet me at @AnnFisherWOSU. You know, in my line of work, I'm Googling, you know, using search engines for every single day for another topic, for a different topic. And I see the topics pop up in the advertising quite a bit. And it irritates me in a way because I wish they just – this is not personal.
Right. Well, it is definitely irritating. On the other hand, Google does it because it's effective.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for something, and it seems to, in many ways, those ads and those queries, they seem to follow you around the net, and everyone has had this experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're wondering why, well, it's mostly about Google because they have all this information. And again, if this stuff pops up, you know, last year I was looking around to buy a ping pong table, and I ended up, nah, I'm not going to buy it. And then for the next month and a half, ping pong table ads appeared everywhere. And, okay, I have to admit it, like a month and a half in, I finally did click on one, and I ended up actually not buying it from there, but
It reinterested you in it?
You know, it worked. It worked, because in some ways this kind of targeted advertisement approach is effective, and that's why people do it.
Tom Henderson of PCWorld.com wrote about how to divorce Google, that used that word. The process starts with an inventory, he said, and we've talked about doing that inventory, but how do you, when you divorce Google, that means you're not going to use it anymore, and you're not going to be able to use it anymore.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's not something that I really advocate or that most people can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can try to do it almost as a, taking a philosophical stand. I think what most people will try to do if they want to lean down their mixture, they might try, you know, making sure not to delete their try to delete cookies. They might, you know, try to get rid of their web history, and that's all very possible. You can try the data liberation piece and see what they have there. I think that's a lot easier than a full divorce because, you know, let's face it, it's hard not to go to Google sites. In fact, you know, in a full divorce, you need to essentially redirect any time you try to go to a Google site somewhere, and that is going to be a mess. Then you're going to have to not only block your cookies, but you're going to have to put something onto your system that will make sure that it will block cookies moving forward. And guess what? That may slow down your machine because you're constantly having to do these checks. So that becomes somewhat irritating. But for instance, something as simple, if this is what you want to do, as changing your default search engine so it's not Google. If you want to, you could try Bing, or you could try DuckDuckGo, which is a site that has very good privacy policies, doesn't collect information about you, and is really quite good.
All right, so how does DuckDuckGo earn a living?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a great question. And, you know, there are ads and the like. They just don't gather all the information, so it's not going to be as targeted. I believe that DuckDuckGo does have some ads and the like. So, there's one possibility. Obviously, you can use Bing as well. And you could argue here that, you know, Microsoft is certainly going to gather information, but since they won't have quite as much information about you because you're not using, conceivably at least, every Microsoft service, that might be better. If you're talking about maps, and we all use, or well, according to the statistics, we almost all use Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
But you could try, you know, OpenStreetMap, which is an open source project, OpenStreetMap.org. You're not going to have those same issues. Of course, then again, you know, it might not be as great in all circumstances as Google Maps, which is just remarkably updated. But OpenStreetMap is using the sort of Wikipedia model, so where, you know, it's open and everyone can contribute. So that becomes an interesting way to do it. Again, of course, there's Bing Maps, if that's what you wanted, or MapQuest and the like. And then you have apps, right? A lot of us, even in the workplace, use shared apps, Google Apps, Google Spreadsheet, you know, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that becomes a tricky one because if your company has, let's say, mandated it, which a lot have, because it's, you know, a very good way to share data or people are just using it, that becomes tricky. But you could try something like Zoho, that's Z-O-H-O, and, you know, that is going to give a lot of the same functionality. And, you know, so suddenly that's one more thing that you might not be doing on Google. Now, I want to stress here that the Google apps are really quite good, you know, and the reason why Google has gotten into the position they're currently in is because they're very good at what they do. That includes aggregating information, of course, but it also means in providing services to people. And that's why the whole divorce thing becomes pretty tricky. It's hard to divorce the spouse that is actually, you know, giving you most of what you want, right?
Mm-hmm. The process in that article talks about super cookies, and I was wondering, what are super cookies?
Yeah, so you know, there are general cookies that we kind of all know about, right? And those are things that are put onto your site, you know, just regularly. Super cookies, and I'm looking through the site here because I was reading through this today and was really quite impressed with exactly what he went through to do this because, well, it was quite a lot of work. But I'm just looking through on super cookies, right? As he mentions, these are settings that are put on your computer. But I think super cookies go across multiple sites.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, this is a little more dangerous, or at least a little more invasive. So, you know, that was one of the things that he was looking at. I think, you know, in this case, he actually used a third-party application to remove all of these and to make sure they didn't come back. But he did note it really slowed things down. That's not something that most of us are willing to do. He used an app. It's a utility called Ghostery, which will pick up adware and block trackers and everything else. You know, one thing you can also just set your browser, and every browser is going to be a little different on this, to not accept cookies, and that's certainly one of the things you can do. You know, his point is that there are super cookies that can get in anywhere, anyway, and if that were the case, then you would want to use an application that would consistently block those as opposed to just doing them as a browser-based approach.
And then you mentioned a little earlier there's a special impact for Android users.
Yes, yeah. Well, this is certainly a big deal. You know, Android, it's once again a Google product. One thing, if any of you have Android phones out there, you notice that whenever you get an application, you know, by default, before you install it, a little screen comes up and tells you what it's going to collect about you. Mm-hmm. And most of us, I think, just say, fine, okay, whatever. What I would recommend here is actually read that, because there are apps that are going to ask for your location, and there's no reason why they would need that, or they'll maybe ask some other things. Then you have to make the decision. After all, you know, it may be a free application, so how am I paying for it? You know, one of the ways that you pay for applications or, you know, apps on phones is with data, some sort of personal data. Essentially, that's what they're using. But it really pays to look at those screens, and you may decide, you know, I do not want this game or this app because it wants information that I don't want to give. If it's a sort of app that's going to find something near you, obviously it's going to need location information, and if you want to use it, you're going to have to say yes. But since all of this is, again, covered under a single policy, now you have, you know, even more information, because think how much information we have on our phones, you know, because of daily usage as we're going from place to place. All that gets added into the giant database because it's all under one account.
Now, this might clinch it. We're running out of time, but this might clinch it for a lot of people. You would lose YouTube if you divorced Google.
Well, yeah, if you say I will not be going to any Google sites, guess what? Mm-hmm. That's one of them. And yes, that would pretty much be a clincher. I mean, you know, Google has managed to weave itself into our daily lives. This is not really insidious. This is again a matter of providing very good service, and this is why the full divorce thing, you know, I hardly see it happening. I do see a weaning off that people can do. And, you know, if you are truly upset about this, you can also, you know, avoid using an Android phone. You could use, you know, Windows Phone 7 or an app, you know, an iOS phone. But you may be giving something up.
Okay, and you said you're not going to do this.
No, I haven't. I really haven't. I mean, you know, it also, the fact that I'm a somewhat public personality would be overstating it, but a somewhat public person.
I disagree.
Because of, you know, what I do, I figure, you know, it's kind of past the point where this is going to help and expect to preserve anything like privacy. Obviously, I'm very careful with things like passwords and everything else, and I do take, you know, various steps, but as far as saying no to Google, I guess I've just said yes to Google myself.
We have a tweet. They say, I have absolutely no fear of an app knowing my location or what I am buying. Am I being naive?
Well, you know, that one of the old arguments that we've often heard is, well, if you don't do anything wrong, you don't really have to fear anything. Of course, you know, occasionally people are accused of things that they actually didn't do, and data or information can be used to distort things or prove things that may, or attempt to prove things that may not be accurate. So I think a lot of people would have the attitude from that tweet, and it certainly does make sense. It's just in some odd circumstances, things start to feel more like Big Brother. And, you know, for those who are already worried about the government, no one wants then, let's say, a second government peeking over your shoulder, one that actually knows more about you.
All right, Steve Fox, thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
Steve Fox, editorial director and vice president of PC World. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The next fresh air, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, who wrote the bestseller Taliban Before 9/11, talks with us about his new book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Join us.
And fresh air begins at noon on 89.7 NPR News. A healthy brain is the key to feeling more fit, staying energized, and being mentally sharp. Learn some simple steps to boost your brain. Watch Use Your Brain to Change Your Age with Dr. Daniel Amen. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for Tech Tuesday comes from Soho Tech, providing computer consulting services to residential and small business customers. More information at 323-4085 or online at sohotechcolumbus.com.
76 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and warming up to a high of 83. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60 degrees. Mostly sunny on Wednesday and a high of 83 as well. Partly cloudy Wednesday night, a low of 60 degrees. Join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow at 11 for Billy Elliot, the musical, and also gender stereotypes facing boys. That discussion during All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Lasers don't really make any sound, but some of them can pop balloons, as in this YouTube demonstration of a Wicked Lasers 1W Arctic Blue laser. Okay, that's the sound of a 1W Arctic Blue laser popping balloons. Joining us now to talk about that and a few other gadgets is Geek.com blogger Russell Holly. Russell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So first, let's start off with the Wicked Lasers 1W Arctic Blue laser. Who needs one?
Nobody.
Okay.
there's not a practical application for owning a 1-watt laser unless you are, you know, in the field of lasers. But I can say that having spent a lot of time with Arctic, with the 1-watt Arctic laser, it's definitely fun to have around and play with. It is most definitely a dangerous adult toy, though.
So they are considered toys. That's why they were made, or just is there anywhere a use for them unless you're an official balloon popper?
Well, most people that use lasers in a productive manner typically use ones that are a lot more powerful,
okay,
as scary as that may seem, to accomplish other tasks. But this really is, you know, just an adult toy. You know, there's really no other way to describe how this thing gets used.
When in the YouTube video that I saw, the laser wasn't that far away from the balloons. How far does this reach? And they can still do that kind of damage, can still burn things.
Burning things requires it to be pretty close.
Okay.
In my tests, you know, you really start to feel the heat from the laser on your skin if you were to point it at your arm, you know, pretty much as far away as, you know, 3 or 4 feet, okay. Though it takes a little while longer for the farther away it is. For stuff that's right up close, you know, an inch or two away from the laser, it'll start to burn things like cardboard and things like that right away. The light that's emitted from the laser, the website claims that it can be seen as far as 3 miles away. And I unfortunately don't have a big field to test that.
You haven't tested that yet. Okay. Well, it is a beautiful light. But I was wondering, you wanted to talk about it. And I was wondering, did you want to talk about this as a cautionary tale? If someone says, Mom, give me the 1W Arctic blue laser.
There's actually a lot of things that have come up in the news recently about this kind of device, not specifically the ones from Arctic Lasers, but just powerful lasers in general.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem that they face, and if things don't get better, they're probably going to get banned here in the United States, is the people who are taking them and shooting them in the sky and hitting, you know, pilots. Who are flying airplanes and things like that.
They reach that far.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, most planes, you know, especially if you live near an airport like I do, you know, they're really not hard to do at all. But also, you know, helicopters that fly by or really any kind of aircraft, it's very dangerous for, you know, lasers to be pointed in that general direction, especially, you know, these kind of lasers are capable of blinding people even on, you know, a reflective surface. You don't even have to point the laser directly at them to cause even temporary blindness. So it's a danger to take these things and wave them around in the sky like you've got a small lightsaber. You know, that's one of the dangers that is faced. And that's why I said, you know, it really is a dangerous adult toy because as much fun as they can be, I mean, I've done some really silly things with them so far, and they come with a really wide variety of filters that you can put on top to create light effects.
Huh.
You can do like a disco ball and things like that. It's really cool to see 1,000 tiny blue dots on your ceiling. It really can be, you know, quite dangerous if it's not used carefully.
How much do they cost?
They are not inexpensive. The most expensive of the ones that they have right now is right around $600.
Wow. You also wanted to talk about the Asus ZenBook UX31 Ultrabook.
So we talked a little bit about Ultrabooks when I was at CES,
right,
if you'll recall.
Yep.
And they were, you know, Intel was really pushing that line and trying to get some of these out. And a lot of them that we saw at CES are just now starting to come to the market. And the Asus ZenBook, specifically the UX31, was one of the more promising ones that we saw at CES. And it really is a neat little laptop.
You said it compares favorably to the MacBook Air. How so?
Well, it's very similar in terms of how thick it is and how heavy it is, and the hardware that's inside, you know, is very comparable. It has, you know, up to 128 gigabyte hard drive with 4 gigabytes of RAM, and really for most users, that's a lot of a lot of things to do, you know, for something that's going to be incredibly mobile. And the battery life, in my opinion, was almost exactly the same as a MacBook Air in terms of using it every day.
How do they achieve that? How do they achieve that kind of battery life?
Well, the interesting thing about these computers is that there aren't any moving parts. There aren't fans. The hard drives that are in them are solid state drives, and so these things can be. They can be used when necessary. You know, so if you're doing something that requires a lot of computing power, then the battery's going to go down faster. But if you're doing things like browsing the web or doing something like that, the power necessary to keep, you know, those parts moving is a lot less than you would see in a traditional laptop.
How big is it? How thin is it, and how much does it weigh? I know we talked about that before, but what does it look like?
Well, it really just looks like a blade, like a rectangular, sheet of metal. It's a lot of times when I've shown this to people, they don't even believe that it's a computer until I touch the center of, you know, the one side and lift up the really, really thin screen. so that you can see, you know, the entire computer. And the interesting thing about the ZenBook is that it's all, you know, that kind of polished aluminum, mm-hmm. like the machined aluminum. So it really does just look like a chunk of metal. And it's not very light. You know, it's certainly lighter than a traditional laptop. It's 45 ounces. But when you pick it up, you definitely feel, you know, the heft. So it's going to be more than, say, an iPad or something like that. But it's definitely less weight than, you know, a traditional 15-inch laptop. And it's so thin. The thickest point is just over half an inch.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger at Geek.com. We are talking about the Asus ZenBook UX31 Ultrabook. If you have a question or comment for Russell on anything, pretty much, I've found, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait. We have about 7 minutes left, so make your call right now. So, Russell, last question on this is, how tough are these things?
Well, it really depends on the construction and what which one you choose as far as what it's being made of. What makes the Asus ZenBook worth it to me is that it's made entirely out of machined aluminum. So it's one solid metal piece with the computer parts on the inside, and that makes the whole thing a lot more durable. And more importantly, because it's entirely made of aluminum, it means that, you know how traditional computers get hot, you know, in certain places?
Yeah.
Because it's made of, you know, that special aluminum, the heat will actually disperse over a much wider area. So you don't have that one spot that gets, you know, blindingly hot when you go to touch it.
You also wanted to talk about did we talk about cost? Are these things exorbitant?
They're right around $1,000, mm-hmm. which is actually cheaper than the MacBook Air with similar specs in it.
Who are they good for? When you think about when you envision who might use one of these, who do you envision?
I think these are perfect for somebody who is a rather constant traveler. You know, someone who needs that traditional computer experience. You know, where you still have the mouse and the keyboard and you know your copy of Windows or you know and isn't quite ready for, let's say, a tablet experience, you know, that someone who but still needs to be very mobile.
We have a comment from Jason via Twitter. He says, Apple did a good job getting the new iPad out this time. I got it within 2 days. The iPad 2 took months. Any sense about how that's doing?
A lot of people said that they did a very good job getting those out. I think Apple yesterday published statistics that over the weekend they sold a million iPads a day.
Jeez.
For the 3 days that it came out. It's really interesting to see, you know, how a lot of different people are responding to that device.
Yeah, there have been complaints. I was looking at, I didn't look closely, but in Washington Post tech blog today, they were talking about people complaining that didn't, you know, Siri's not there, but the people knew that when they signed up.
Right.
So you wanted to talk about the House of Marley TTR headphones. Would that be the house of, like, Bob Marley?
Yes, actually, okay. It is. It is members of Bob Marley's family that actually has this company that releases very eco-friendly, you know, audio equipment for a lot of different types of people. And the top of their line is are called these TTRs, and they're a little different. They're very big. You know, they're almost like studio headphones, and they're actually powered by a pair of AA batteries. I'm sorry, AAA batteries, mm-hmm. And the sound experience was really unique for me. It was something that I put on. I listen, you know, I use a lot of different headphones and earbuds and things like that, you know, as a tech reviewer, and this was one of the first set of headphones that when I turned them on, the world around me just kind of stopped. You know, I couldn't hear the person standing next to me who was having a conversation with me as I hit the play button on, you know, on my phone. And the music wasn't even particularly loud, and it was just a very encompassing experience.
Okay, but you said many of your colleagues didn't feel the same way about that. You said that's because of audio leak. You said TTRs did nothing to keep the sound inside, and that sounds like a negative to me in a way.
It was definitely a downside to realize that the people, not just sitting next to me, but the people in the other room could actually hear the song that I was playing. And again, I didn't even have the volume all the way up. I was just, you know, it was at a reasonable level as far as I was concerned. So it's something that, you know, you really as amazing as these sound, you really can't use them in, you know, like a traditional office setting or even, you know, on a train ride home or something like that, because you're sharing that music with everyone as though you have, you know, a little boombox on your head.
And unfortunately, they don't work without the batteries. So if they die while you're on the go, you're out of luck.
Absolutely.
Although it sounds like you won't go very many places with it. You said the sound is incredibly clean. Some of the most balanced headphones you've ever enjoyed.
Absolutely. It was an interesting experience because when I test a pair of headphones, I try to go for as many different, you know, genres of music as possible. And the first thing that I always try is, you know, something that's purely instrumental.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing about these, when I started playing the instrumental music, was that it was very authentic sounding. I could hear, you know, the violin as though, you know, I were, you know, sitting listening to someone play the violin.
One of the things you mentioned at the top, the eco-friendly, I wanted to make sure, how do they make them eco-friendly? What's eco-friendly about them?
So the interesting thing about a lot of different pieces of hardware that we buy these days is that while they may be made from recycled parts, the device itself is not easy to break down and recycle. Take the new iPad, for example, is made of recycled aluminum and glass and things like that. But the device itself is actually so hard to dismantle that, you know, it's actually not a recyclable product. The House of Marley headphones are made from recycled aluminum and biodegradable canvas. And they actually come apart, not very easily, but there are instructions to take it apart for recycling. So if you were to take these to a recycling center, you know, they could break them down into the individual recyclable parts and recycle them instead of having to throw it into the big trash heap.
And is that, you said that's an overall theme of the House of Marley?
Almost everything that they do has that exact same theme, down to some of their earbuds, which actually are made of wood.
The Smile Jamaica earbuds.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I had actually never seen that on a pair of headphones before. It was very polished wood, very much like what you see on acoustic guitars.
Well, I like it that they have thick fabric-covered braided cord.
It's my favorite thing. There are a lot of companies that have started to do this now because, you know, they don't tangle, it's a much higher quality, and they're less prone to damage.
Yeah.
Because they're that fabric braided cord. And the House of Marley, everything that they do has this same, you know, thick braided cord, and it's so nice because it doesn't ever tangle. I mean, I've taken the headphones and the earbuds, and I've stuffed them in as many pockets and zippers and things as I could, and they never come out, you know, tangled up and messy.
Yeah, you've definitely sold me on those, Russell. Russell, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley is a tech blogger at geek.com. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, AllSides intern Corinne Gleckler, AllSides production assistant Ayan Sheik, high school intern Grace Bachman. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSH News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Once again, thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from CATCO. Next Fall by Jeffrey Knopfs is about an accident victim relying on his partner's family for help, forcing all the characters to examine faith and spirituality. March 14th through April 1st at the Rife Center. Details at CATCO.org.